The headlines: Israeli settlers go ahead with their controversial flag march in the old city of occupied Al-Quds amid Palestinians' warning of retaliation. Iran calls on Turkey to respect Syria's sovereignty after Ankara threatened to launch a new offensive to create a so-called safe zone in the border area. And fierce fighting is reported in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces have intensified their attacks to capture more areas. Hello and welcome, everybody. Israeli settlers have held their flag march in occupied Al-Quds city despite prior warnings by Palestinians who see the parade as provocative. The settlers crossed the Damascus Gate and marched through the old city's Muslim quarter. The flag march event marks the anniversary of Israel's 1967 occupation of East Al-Quds, where Al-Aqsa Mosque is located. Palestinians have already warned Israel of consequences. Ahead of the controversial parade, dozens of Israeli settlers protected by forces stormed Al-Aqsa, beating Palestinians and injuring at least three. Several Palestinians were also arrested after Israeli forces attacked worshippers inside the mosque. Palestinians across the occupied West Bank have held counter-rallies denouncing the Israeli flag march. Israeli forces attacked protesters in the cities of Nablus and Bethlehem. Several Palestinians were injured as a result. The Palestinian government says Israel is playing with fire by allowing settlers to desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque. Jordan, which is the custodian of the holy site, has condemned Israel for allowing settlers there. It has also slammed the flag march as provocative, warning that it can lead to more violence. Well, people in other parts of the world have shown their support for Palestinians in response to the so-called Israeli flag march in occupied Al-Quds. In the German capital, Berlin, dozens of cars took part in a pro-Palestine rally. The vehicles were draped in Palestinian flags as the drivers honked their horns. There have also been demonstrations of solidarity in the UK, Austria, South Africa, and Lebanon. A high-ranking Israeli official has visited Saudi Arabia and met with a senior Saudi official, fueling speculation that the two sides could be taking reciprocal steps toward the normalization of their relations. But this is not the first contact of its kind. It's an open secret that Riyadh and Tel Aviv have had an unofficial behind-the-scenes relationship and have even coordinated security-related issues in the past.
A senior Israeli official has traveled to the Saudi capital and met inside the royal palace with a high-ranking Saudi official. According to Israel's Channel 12, the visit was meant to coordinate security cooperation between the two sides, which included the alleged common threats posed by Iran. The visit was linked to the two sides' mutual interest in leveling up their relations. In March, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said, "Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy, but looks to it as a potential ally," saying they have many interests that can pursue together. Riyadh and Tel Aviv have no formal diplomatic relations, although it is widely believed that they do have contacts behind the scenes. There are plenty of examples of this. In 2018, it was reported that the chief of staff of the Israeli army met his Saudi counterpart to discuss terrorism and the alleged threat from Iran. Saudi Arabia's decision to allow Air India flights to and from Tel Aviv to transit through Saudi airspace are tangible signs of a shift. When bin Salman was asked about Israel having a say on stolen Palestinian land, he said he believes that the Jewish people have a right to a nation-state in at least part of their ancestral homeland. U.S. President Joe Biden is going to travel to the occupied Palestinian territories. Biden administration officials are in talks with the Saudis about arranging a potential in-person meeting between Biden and the Saudi prince for the first time. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's advisor, Eyal Hulata, is expected to travel to the U.S. next week. Earlier this week, two senior U.S. officials reportedly visited Riyadh as the Biden administration is quietly mediating a Red Sea deal between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt that involves the transfer of two strategic islands, Tiran and Sanafir, in the Red Sea from Egyptian to Saudi sovereignty with Israeli consent. The deal could also pave the way for the official announcement of the normalization of ties between Riyadh and Tel Aviv. When asked about the report, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan refused to deny it, only saying more steps needed to be taken to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2020, Israel's then Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Riyadh and met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This year saw Washington brokering normalization of relations between the Israeli regime and some Arab states, including United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia's key Arab allies in the region. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause.
Saudi Arabia, like other Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf, has kept its relationship with Israel under wraps for some time. The monarchy has not recognized Israel since its occupation of Palestinian land back in 1948, and traditionally Riyadh's official policy towards the Middle East conflict has been supportive of Palestinian Arabs and against Israel. But just like any other Persian Gulf Arab state, Saudi Arabia has failed to take any actual steps that would promote the cause of Palestine.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have for years been conducting covert talks on diplomatic, security, and business affairs, and now Washington is trying to improve ties with Riyadh. U.S. officials are even seeking to organize a meeting between Biden and the Saudi crown prince. This comes against the backdrop of the global energy crisis caused by the war in Ukraine. Russia-Ukraine conflict continues to rock the global energy market. The U.S. is finding itself increasingly reliant on Saudi Arabia, the world's largest crude oil exporter.
A Zionist entity like Israel, I can't really call them a country because they're not. Palestine is the legitimate country. Israel has usurped and stolen the land. So I would caution any nation. I look at what Israel has done to the United States, how they have infiltrated and use the Jewish population in the U.S. to influence our foreign policy in a manner that is no longer favorable to the American people, but instead is favorable to the government of Israel.
Saudi Arabia has refrained from normalizing ties with Israel, unlike Bahrain and UAE, saying it would not do so without a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But bin Salman calling Tel Aviv a potential ally could indicate that Riyadh has already betrayed the Palestinian cause, and admitting it overtly is only a matter of time.
We're going to go back to our top story for this half hour. Israeli settlers have held their flag march in occupied Al-Quds City despite prior warnings by Palestinians who see the parade as provocative. People also in other parts of the world have shown their support for Palestinians in response to the so-called Israeli flag march in occupied Al-Quds. Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nimr, joins us now from Ramallah. Professor Nimr, it's great to have you with us. Tensions were high today in occupied Al-Quds. Talk to us about today's events and what do you think Israelis are trying to achieve by carrying out these provocative measures?
It's this kind of march. They usually do it every year, but this year particularly, it's even more tension and more vicious by the Israeli settlers who are, trying to even get to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. And this morning there was the incursion on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It was unprecedented before. More than 1,600 something of settlers entered this morning Al-Aqsa compound. And they, for the very first time, they raised the Israeli flag and they were dancing and chanting inside Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Israeli forces, since yesterday, they make Jerusalem as a camp or a military base for their more than 3,000 soldiers and police members were in Jerusalem since yesterday. They were closing all the roads. They were also, they closed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Al-Qibli Mosque in Al-Aqsa compound against the morning prayer, and they locked even the people who are inside from the outside with chains. They prevented the Palestinians to reach Jerusalem from any other city around. All that, the preparation for this march, which happens every year. Now, with the Palestinians, they are against it, not only against it, but also they resist it. You know, before I came here to the studio, there was a demonstration in Jerusalem by the Palestinians in Salah al-Din Street, and the Palestinians were raising the Palestinian flag in front of the Israeli army that was very near to Abab al-Sahira, al-Sahira Gate, and it's not that very far from Damascus Gate, where is now this demonstration is gathering. Now, the Palestinians are saying that if the Israeli, in their march, they suppose they go to through the old city of Jerusalem in a path to go to Al-Buraq Wall, if they entered Al-Aqsa Mosque, that will be the it for the Palestinian resistance, especially from Gaza, who gave an ultimatum to the Israeli that they are going to send rockets to Jerusalem at 6 o'clock if they did so. But we don't know to what extent the Israeli would allow, the police would allow those settlers or not. The Palestinians are trying to resist in many ways in Jerusalem. Many were injured today. Many were arrested. Only for raising the Palestinian flag, they were arrested. And we think that this march is provoking the Palestinians in order to, try to say that we are controlling Jerusalem. And it's supposed to be during the day of occupation of Jerusalem 55 years ago and annexation of Jerusalem to Israel, as they claim. But for the old city of Jerusalem, it's still under the control of the Palestinians, and the Palestinians definitely refuse. The fact that they have all these policemen and all these soldiers in Jerusalem, it means that really they don't control Jerusalem. And still, Jerusalem is controlled by its own people, the Palestinian people, who refuse all kind of atrocities against Jerusalem and Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they will continue to defend it.
All right, thanks a lot to Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Mr. Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, Iran is calling on Turkey to respect Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity after Ankara announced plans for a new military operation in the Arab country. Foreign Ministry spokesman says that Tehran is opposed to any recourse to military action and the use of force to resolve disputes. According to Said Khatibzadeh, such measures violate the sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries and only complicate the situation. He further said Iran understands Turkey's security concerns, but that the only way to address those concerns is through dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with its neighbors. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has threatened to launch a new military operation in Syria to create what he calls a safe zone in the border area. Author and commentator John Steppen blames the U.S. and NATO provocations for unrest across the world, including on the Turkish-Syrian border.
The Syrian situation, the incursions into Syria, are something that have happened over the last six, seven, 8 years. I mean, it's been a source of unease and anger on the part of Erdogan in Turkey, and they do have some concerns with the stability or security in the south with the Kurds. But, you know, this is all, I mean, if you take all of this kind of incoherence and contradiction, you can lay it at the feet of U.S.-NATO provocation. I mean, that's really the problem here. These are the sources of global unrest right now in the most acute form is U.S. imperialist expansion in the form of NATO right to the borders of Russia, their open statement they want regime change in Moscow and so forth, just as they wanted regime change in Damascus. They've said they want Assad gone. This is the problem, is U.S., you know, American exceptionalism, this imperialist mindset that the U.S. can play the role of policeman to the planet and make the world safe for Western capital, Western business, and that's really the goal.
The Russian military is stepping up its campaign to take over the city of Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine. Local officials say the city is under heavy shelling with no estimates available of the scale of damage or casualties from today's fighting. On Saturday, they say at least 2 people died and 13 buildings were destroyed in the city. The Russian military says it is taking control of the nearby rail hub of Liman in Donetsk, but according to Ukrainian officials, the city has not yet fallen. Moscow is pushing to seize the entire eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, where it says it wants to protect the local pro-Russia population. It's also hitting areas farther away, including the capital Kiev, with airstrikes. Well, that's a wrap for now. Stick around.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Researchers found that reducing the amount of air-based pollutants would have a profound impact on public health in the immediate term, and that it would also have long-term positive effects when it comes to transitioning away from unsustainable energy sources and addressing the climate crisis as a whole. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading Eliminating air pollution could save more than 53,000 lives per year, study says. Here's the story. A new study has concluded that tens of thousands of premature deaths in the U.S. could be avoided if air pollution was reduced or completely eliminated. The study published by researchers from the University of Wisconsin, UW, in the journal GeoHealth recently notes that by eliminating air pollution resulting from energy-related activities in the U.S., more than 53,000 premature deaths could be avoided on an annual basis. The prevention of those deaths would also save $608 million in benefits relating to illnesses and deaths caused by air pollution. The UW researchers reached this conclusion by analyzing data from the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, and by using health models to gauge the benefits of eliminating air-polluting particulates, including sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides. These particles get deep into the lungs and cause both respiratory and cardiac ailments, said Jonathan Petz, a UW professor and one of the study's authors, adding they are pretty much the worst pollutant when it comes to mortality and hospitalization. While states could still potentially save lives if they acted alone, there would be greater benefits with higher levels of cooperation due to how these types of particulates transport themselves over state lines, noted the study's lead author, graduate student Nicholas Malex, adding, if Wisconsin were to act alone, they get a certain amount of benefit, but if they act in concert with partners in the region or as part of a nationwide effort, you get more benefit. Researchers found that reducing the amount of air-based pollutants would have a profound impact on public health in the immediate term, and that it would also have long-term positive effects when it comes to transitioning away from unsustainable energy sources and addressing the climate crisis as a whole. Many other research studies have come to similar conclusions. A study from last year, for example, found that 74 million lives could be saved by the end of this century if energy-based air pollution was eliminated by the year 2050. A reduction in pollutants would also likely benefit groups of people who are more susceptible than others to these types of pollutants, an EPA reporter stated. These groups include children, pregnant women, older adults, and individuals with pre-existing heart and lung disease, the EPA said, as well as people in low socioeconomic neighborhoods and communities that may be more vulnerable to air pollution.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we looked into the adverse effects and potential dangers of psychotropic drugs. We went to France, the number one user of such medication, to see how psychotropic drugs prescribed much too readily and in a cocktail to cure feelings of anxiety and depression have in some cases led to madness, suicide, extreme acts of violence, and murder. Yet the root cause of the extensive use of such drugs seems to be much more than naive and ignorant doctors and desperate patients, especially when a multi-million dollar industry is at stake. Stay with us for the rest of the documentary.
In the Congress room, many conferences take place one after another, but nobody is dealing with the dangers of antidepressants. One of them is led by Anthony Rothschild, a psychiatrist well known for his successful books on psychotropic drugs. The great specialist is holding a debate on the adaptation of treatments depending on the illness. But not once does he say that antidepressants should not be prescribed. Our question is straightforward.
It seems that there is a lot of danger with antidepressants. What do you think about this? Like suicide or, murders?
No. I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, but I just told you there's no reliable scientific evidence that antidepressants cause people to commit murder or any other crime or suicide.
So how come that on boxes?
All right, this is not serious, okay?
Is this a surprising reaction? Anthony Rothschild also has conflicts of interest with an impressive number of pharmaceutical companies.
So I told you what I thought. You're going to keep asking me the same question.
Okay.
Well, you got my quote, all right?
Okay, very good.
How can such things still be said in this day and age when on all the stands promoting psychotropic medication, whole boards are covered by signs warning of side effects? Among the several side effects, the risk of suicide or violent behavior is prioritized by all. These warnings are a legal obligation enforced by medical organizations. But how much are these warnings worth next to the publicity hype from the pharmaceutical companies?
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. What do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways.
These ads, banned in France, reach tens of millions of households in the United States, one of the rare countries where the promotion of medication is allowed. For the promoters of these ads, a new customer is a captive customer. This is what Michael Baum denounces, a lawyer specializing in the pharmaceutical industry. This man is a nightmare for the laboratories. His trials have cost them billions of dollars. His theme, denouncing the addictive effects of medication.
One of the issues with these drugs is once you're on, you can't get off. They become a captive audience. And they get trained, basically, the patients get trained to stay on it. It's if they take the drug and then stop the drug, they start experiencing these brain zaps, or they start experiencing these nausea symptoms or these severe headaches or dizziness. And then they take the drug. They take it back, they go back on it, and it goes away. Well, they get reinforced with the concept of, I need to stay on it. And they think that maybe, and what doctors used to think, was that they were relapsing back into their depression. That wasn't what was happening at all.
The dangers of psychotropic drugs have been well known for a long time. Since September 1991, the American Medication Agency has had to react against waves of complaints against Prozac, the grandfather of modern antidepressants. This drug has been blamed for hundreds of suicides and murders, and administration officials are getting together to determine whether a correlation exists between Prozac and acts of violence. In front of this committee of reputed psychiatrists are the families of victims.
My husband didn't believe me. He was a pharmacist. We came back, and on April 30, he just blew his brains out in front of all of us. How many more have to die before somebody looks? If we made a mistake, we're humans.
After being on Prozac for 21 days, my wife shot and killed both of these two boys right here. She turned the gun to herself and shot herself twice. I heard these people talking about scientific data. For those that don't say we have scientific data.
I entered therapy 1 year ago as a victim of rape. I stand before you today a victim of Prozac. It baffles my mind to think that a prescription drug I could simply compare to a felony of rape. But yes, they can be compared, because if a drug robs you of your will to live, then it has committed a felony equal to that of rape.
She shot herself on the head.
This was the date of my first...
For a whole day, witnesses will make statements. It's overwhelming.
I firmly believe the drug...
The internist...
How many more people are going to be killed and maimed before you do something? You have the power to change things. You have the power to listen to what we say and investigate what we say. We need help.
Following the statements, the committee votes.
There is credible evidence to support a conclusion that antidepressant drugs cause the emergence and or intensification of suicidality and or other violent behaviors. Those in favor of that statement vote yes. Those opposed to that statement, no.
There is total surprise. Unanimously, the committee declares that there is no link between Prozac and the violence described by the families of the victims.
Vote on the following statement.
Jeffrey Lieberman is a member of the committee. Later, he goes on to be the all-powerful president of the American Psychiatric Association. And of the 10 psychiatrists present during the vote, 9 of them had conflicts of interest with one or several pharmaceutical companies. When Prozac was launched, the Lilly Pharmaceutical Company worked very hard. But one of the board directors even denounced the methods he had himself used to boost sales of the drug. He is John Virapen, and he was director of Lilly in Sweden until 1988. And it's not his style to beat around the bush.
Men and patients, we're consumers, and we're being ripped off right, left, and center. And unfortunately, as I see it today, the drug companies have the power, total power. They are in all corners of the industrial complex. They're in there somewhere doing dirty work.
And you were a part of it.
And I was a part. That's why I'm able to tell you all of this. I was a part of it. I've done my hands are dirty. I'm trying to clean now. It's redemption time.
It's time for redemption. And John Buropin has written a book with a provocative title, Side Effects, Death. Notably, it discusses the way in which he was asked to conceal side effects.
The doctors prescribe to the patient, but don't tell them anything because they don't know. They rely completely on what the pharma industry tells them. These little salesmen that run around, I was a salesman too. And they used to instruct me when I was a salesman. The first thing is, you don't talk side effects with doctors.
Why do they do that? Because they want to make money, 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 money. They don't care about your lives. They only care about their wallets.
From conferences to interviews, John Buropin does not hesitate to reveal what he implemented to encourage sales, corruption, gifts, and trips.
To children.
General practitioners, they don't usually get to go to them big Congress and World Congress here and there. So one day I got the idea that maybe we should do something with these guys. So I gathered a whole bunch of them and took them to Singapore. Fly them down to Singapore and gave them the works. I mean, it was exclusive. When they came back, my sales escalated.
In light of these accusations, Lilly, the lab that created Prozac, did not wish to meet with us. But this is what they said by email. John Buropin has not been employed by Lilly since 1988. He therefore cannot be considered as a credible source of information concerning the current activities of the group, its motives, or practices. The Lilly Pharmaceutical Company, like all the others, nevertheless fought hard so that the American administration did not impose a black box warning on antidepressant leaflets, an explicit caution against the risks of suicide or violent behavior. But in 2004, finally, it became a done deal. This victory is owed to the activism of victims' families and their lawyers, such as Andy Vickery. The pharmaceutical industry also has a bone to pick with this Texan. He also received billions in compensation during the famous arrangements whereby laboratories preferred to pay out rather than stand trial. To better explain how a pill can kill, he makes use of a puzzle. His demonstration, he claims, applies for all psychotropic drugs.
Is there a phenomenon, a distinct phenomenon, of Prozac-induced suicide?
The first attribute is the patients became suddenly suicidal. People who've never thought of killing themselves, of harming themselves, take one of these drugs, whoom, they go instantly from that feeling to death. The second piece of the puzzle was that the suicides were all violent. I've shared with you already the story of Pat Williamson. She was on Prozac 9 days when she came in one morning to her husband and said, "Honey, would you show me how to kill myself?" And her husband said, "Oh, Pat, please." And he decides to go check up on her after 15 or 20 minutes and finds that she has made 100 mutilating cuts in her body. The third piece of the puzzle that Eli Lilly noticed was an obsessive quality to the act. It's just this sudden impulse to do something really violent, really dangerous to themselves or others. And it's just, they're just overwhelmed by it. They're obsessed with the idea. And they cannot control their behavior. In the period of time between the person starts to take the drug and the time of their death or suicide attempt, that there's abnormal behavior. Something different is going on. And sometimes the medical help is, "Oh, you just need to take more of this drug. Let's increase your dose." It's like, "Oh, there's a little fire. Let's pour some gasoline on it." And the final piece of the puzzle is, almost all of the cases that I have handled, the death has happened within 30 days of the time the person either started the drug or had their dose increased.
Once again, Lilly Laboratory only answers our accusations by mail. They explain that one of the most striking studies in the last few years, shows that there is a decrease in suicide, -32%, and in mortality, -49%, when depressed patients take antidepressants. But what is the truth? This study is contested by other studies that claim the contrary. And if in the United States, thousands of victims came to the forefront, then why would France be spared, the leading consumer worldwide of psychotropic drugs? In April 2014, a court trial would clarify the current state of affairs in an enlightening manner. Back in December 2008, Jean is depressed. He struggles to deal with his professional life, and at the birth of his son, he attempts suicide. He therefore went to the psychiatrist, Dr. Gossaris. The doctor recommends that he try out a new antidepressant, which was not yet available on the market, Brintellix. Jean did not react to the treatment. The psychiatrist proposed to double the dosage. A few days later, Jean set himself on fire. Corinne, Jean's wife, refused to believe that it was a random suicide. She alerted the authorities, and Dr. Gossaris was put under inspection on 7 charges. He was accused of embezzlement, but worse, putting others' lives in danger for at least 8 patients, including Jean, Corinne's husband. On April 30th, 2014, the doctor was strangely judged in Bordeaux, the court where he himself was a judiciary expert. He received a suspended sentence of 6 months that he appealed. But why would the pharmaceutical company Lundbeck, the creators of the antidepressants, not be investigated themselves? The pharmaceutical company Lundbeck has no interest in this affair going public. They've invested millions in order to get Brintellix approved by medical authorities. However, Jean was not at all the same since his dosage of Brintellix was raised, as described by Corinne and her mother. For Lundbeck, it is therefore not Brintellix that is to blame, but Jean's depression. It's a credible defense, which is used by all pharmaceutical companies when they are blamed. However, we also met with other victims of this trial period, and bizarrely, they all describe the same symptoms. Such as Christian Mounier, who also tested Brintellix for 8 months. Since, he has lost his job, his memory, and he describes himself as a vegetable. A man who is no longer himself, another who commits suicide, apparently devastating side effects for 8 sufferers. But there was also the suicide of 2 more patients just after coming off Brintellix. This bad streak should have alerted the authorities. However, nothing would come of it, as on the same day as Jean's self-immolation, Dr. Gossaris wiped his name from the file. His death was therefore no longer related to the clinical tests. The medical authorities explained to us that for each test of a drug, they only receive the results achieved across the whole territory. The botched trials of Dr. Gossaris were therefore lost in the mass and mixed with several other accepted studies across the world, as this document shows, that makes Brintellix's market release official. Lundbeck throws the blame back to the public health authorities. So what can be said of the package insert that we found in the United States, where Brintellix has been approved since 2013? Side effects are documented in 2 whole pages. Especially, though, the principal paragraph warns against the raised risk of suicidal thoughts and behaviors. It's the famous black box warning. In other words, the highest alert level. In France, Brintellix has just been approved for sale on the market. It has therefore been judged as useful in fighting depression. The doors are slammed shut. Jean is responsible for his own atrocious suicide. Just like the death of Mark, Aurélie's murderous thoughts and suicide attempt, or the fall of Christian Mounier. If the effectiveness of such medication on most serious depressive states cannot be denied, how many more tragedies need to occur before the effects of psychotropic drugs on some patients are truly recognized?
Well, it seems that as long as money and power are involved in the realm of healthcare, pills that are expected to cure depression actually cause suicide and murder. And that's it for this week's program. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
In the Limelight.
The U.S. has the most number of weapons, with an estimated 400 million guns in circulation. That's more guns than people in the United States, and almost half of the civilian-owned guns on the planet. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan writers. This article is published under the heading, Gun Massacres Are the Grotesque Pinnacle of American Exceptionalism. Here's the story. Together We Rise reads the motto on a wall of Robb Elementary School in Ovalle, Texas. The school serves about 600 students in the second through fourth grades. Over 90% are Latinx. 19 children between the ages of 9 and 11 and two of their teachers were murdered there recently when an 18-year-old gunman armed with a semi-automatic AR-15 rifle. The shooter, Salvador Ramos, was killed at the school by a U.S. Border Patrol agent. At a news conference recently, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican who consistently rejects gun control, blamed the shortage of mental health services for the atrocity. Manny Oliver, whose son, Joaquin, was killed in the Parkland, Florida school massacre in 2018, said on the Democracy Now! News Hour, "This is not about mental health that happens all around the planet. This is about guns and easy access to guns." In the middle of Governor Abbott's briefing, Beto O'Rourke, who is running against Abbott in the upcoming gubernatorial election, interrupted saying, "The time to stop the next shooting is right now, and you are doing nothing. You said this is not predictable. This is totally predictable." Others on the stage cursed at O'Rourke, demanding he leave as police closed in O'Rourke exited. His accusations were echoed in a tweet by Amanda Gorman, the youngest presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history, who wrote, "It takes a monster to kill children, but to watch monsters kill children again and again and do nothing isn't just insanity, it is inhumanity." Many U.S. politicians parrot the line that this is the greatest nation on earth. American exceptionalism is ingrained in the U.S. culture. Americans have the most number of weapons, with an estimated 400 million guns in circulation. That's more guns than people in the United States, and almost half of the civilian-owned guns on the planet. Americans are without question number one when it comes to mass shootings. The Gun Violence Archive has counted 213 so far this year alone, and more than 3,000 since 2014. A shocking number of U.S. mass shootings take place in schools. According to the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, there have been 2,054 school shootings in the United States since 1970, with 681 deaths. Canada has had a total of 8 school shootings in about the same time frame, from 1975, with a total of 31 victims killed. Mexico has had 17 school shootings since 2004, with 15 victims killed. In Australia in 1996, a young man with an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle massacred 35 people in the tourist town of Port Arthur, Tasmania. Australia is a country of gun lovers, but reaction to the shooting was swift, with a popular national mandatory gun buyback for semi-automatic guns. Some 643,000 guns were collected and destroyed. Since then, Australia has experienced just one mass shooting of the type that occurs almost daily in the U.S. Similar policies were established in other wealthy industrialized nations in the wake of mass shootings in Canada, New Zealand, the UK, and Norway. When access to guns is restricted and gun ownership is more difficult, gun violence dramatically drops. There is consensus on tightening gun laws in the United States. Preventing those suffering from mental illness from owning or accessing guns has between 85 to 90% bipartisan support, according to the Pew Research Center. Banning clips that hold more than 10 bullets has 64% bipartisan support. A federal database tracking every gun sale enjoys 66% support. Why won't elected officials heed the electorate? One clear reason is the decades of lobbying by the National Rifle Association. The American Gun Lobby, supported by American gun manufacturers, is alive and well. Robin Lloyd, managing director of GIFORTS, the organization dedicated to preventing gun violence led by former Congress member Gabby GIFORTS, who was shot in the head in a mass shooting in Tucson, said, "The National Rifle Association has been weakened by self-inflicted wounds of greed and mismanagement of funds. Another organization is the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which spends more on lobbying against gun violence prevention measures in Washington than NRA does. They are the true face of the American corporate gun lobby." Nicole Golden, executive director of Texas Gun Sense, organizes for Common Sense Gun Control in the Lone Star State. "I've been involved in gun violence prevention in Texas for almost a decade," she said on Democracy Now!, adding, "our work has basically been shut down. Despite the power of the gun lobby, she's not without hope," saying, "we are here for the long haul. We're not going anywhere. We will keep chipping away, working in our communities to pass meaningful change and building this extremely strong movement. As the children of Robb Elementary School proclaim, together we rise."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.